Well, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 4 this evening, continuing on with our series of kingly lessons. Covered chapters 1, 2, and 3. We've seen how a simple mother's faith is able to change the course of a nation. That's the events that we're getting into are the results of her faith changing the nation. Things are happening in Israel here in chapter 4. This is when it all starts to come together, and it all started with Hannah's simple faith that God could provide her a son, which he did. Chapter 2, we saw Hannah's song of praise. We looked at Eli's failure as a leader of the people. But we also see in chapter 3 with the call of Samuel that Eli is not a completely faithless man, even though he wasn't completely competent as a leader either. I think his heart's in the right place, but a lot of the things that he did were very misplaced and ineffective. We're going to see some more signs of his faithfulness here in this chapter as we get to chapter 4, and we're going to be looking at lessons of failure. Lessons of failure is going to be our next kingly lesson. What do you do when you've blown it and blown it big? How do you respond to those sorts of things? Well, we'll take a straw poll here tonight. How many of you have ever blown it? Had a horrendous blunder in your life? Yeah, we all have, haven't we? If you're 10 days old, you've probably had a horrendous blunder in your life at some point. And the older we get, tends to be that the failures, hopefully as you're gaining wisdom, you're avoiding more and more of them, but the ones you do make seem to get a little bigger. The potential for them gets that way. Well, we've got the sort of the culmination of failures hitting us in chapter 4. In chapter 2, a prophet came to Eli and told him the word of the Lord that because of the way he had allowed his sons to profane the sacrifices and to profane the tabernacle through their actions as priests, that Eli's family line would no longer continue before the Lord in service. He was going to be removed from being the high priest. And as a sign, Samuel told him that as a sign these things were about to come to pass very, very soon, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, would be both killed in one day. All of these things are going to come to pass. We're coming to a climactic point in the book of Samuel here where things are going to change, and it's all the result of failures for the most part on people's behalves. But the first verse of the chapter, chapter 4, the word of Samuel came to all Israel, really is a verse that belongs back with chapter 3, because if you go to the end of chapter 3 and look at what's going on, Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and let none of his words fall to the ground, and all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Oh, that's the connected thought there. It's discussing Samuel's rise to prominence among the people of Israel. It's showing how his teaching is becoming prominent. He's becoming a leader. He's rising and going to be taking over the position from Eli, who was the judge of Israel at the time. But as Eli is growing older and his influence is diminishing, Samuel's rising, and God is going to be putting him in that position of leadership that he's going to need to have him in so that Samuel can become the judge of Israel for the rest of his life. So the first one of chapter 4 rightly belongs with chapter 3. And the first word of chapter 4 tells you that we're starting a new thought. That word in Hebrew that we translate as now, it sometimes gets translated or and or but basically means here's a new thought. Now take this. Here's a whole new idea. So we're starting off into something different. So we've transitioned from Samuel's rise to prominence to an entirely new part of the narrative. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines, and they encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. We have here in this lessons of failure, the first thing is a surprise defeat. Israel goes up to battle Philistia. And I wanted to show you. Oh, I forgot to open it. Give me just a second. Talk amongst yourselves. Here, Glenn just got a hold of this program, and so we give him a little show of what you can do here with some of this. I'm going to load the satellite imagery. There we go. And you can see there is the land of Israel. These are satellite images. No, there's nothing up there? Oh, you're still on that. Well, isn't that interesting? Okay. Yeah, right. Okay, let's try this. Okay, there you go. Now, as you can see, here is the land of Israel. I'm going to look up AFEC again. This is what I should have had. Whoop. You can see down here, yeah, good, you're seeing what I'm seeing, okay. I've done that before while I have the screen up here with just my notes on it, and I'll say, look right here, and I'll point at my screen and say, well, you guys can't see what I'm looking at. Yeah, it's right there. It's like talking to a little kid on the phone, and they say, hey, can you see my Legos? Look at this. They do that to my parents all the time when they're trying to talk to them. Right here is, if you can see this, is Shiloh. This is where the tabernacle was encamped at. All right, it's mentioned at various places throughout the Old Testament, and it was particularly designed to be a mobile encampment. We saw in the last couple of chapters that there were some outbuildings around the tabernacle that had been put in place to store things, the offerings that came in, residences for the priests who were on duty at the time. So it became somewhat semi-permanent, but it did move around. Sometimes we find it at Gilgal, sometimes we find it at Shiloh. In David's time, we're going to find it at Nob when he goes to get the sword of Goliath, and Saul has all the priests slaughtered. So it does move around somewhat, but during this part of the narrative, it's encamped at Shiloh. Now, Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They camped at Ebenezer. Ebenezer is a place we're not really sure where it's at because it doesn't really tell us. In fact, it is a site that's not actually named yet in history. If you were following Israel along in history and you came to 1 Samuel chapter 4, even people in 1 Samuel would say, "What's Ebenezer?" Because Samuel doesn't call it Ebenezer until 1 Samuel 7. Okay? They have another battle there, and Samuel leads the Israelites to victory, and he sets up a stone in the middle of the field and calls it Ebenezer, which means rock of my help. Okay? Eben means rock, and Ezer means my help. So he sets up the rock of Ebenezer, the rock of my help, in 1 Samuel 7. So what's going on here is when the person is writing 1 Samuel, obviously, we're after all of these facts, so everybody knew where Ebenezer was when he wrote it. We were talking about this a little bit this morning in giving directions. You say, hey, when we were in West Virginia, people like to give us directions and say, you know, it's down by the old, what was that, Shop and Save building. Well, the Shop and Save building didn't exist anymore. It's not that it wasn't a Shop and Save anymore, it's the building wasn't there. So when they tell you to take the road and turn left by the Shop and Save, say, what Shop and Save? It's not there. But this is how landmarks get named and how people know where they're at. And Ebenezer wasn't named yet, but it will be named in just a few chapters. And so as the person is writing 1 Samuel, everybody that was reading his book would have known where it was. It took on the significance of a national monument, somewhat like Gettysburg or Appomattox Courthouse or Bunker Hill. We know where those places are now because they came to a place of prominence in history because of the events that happened there. And the same thing with Ebenezer. It was a place where many battles were fought, though we're not entirely sure where it's at. In 1 Samuel 7, it tells us that Samuel set up the stone of Ebenezer somewhere between Mizpah, which is right here, Can you guys see that cursor moving at all? Can you see Mizpah there? That's got to be incredibly small text. I can make it a little bigger. Okay. So right here is Mizpah. Okay. Somewhere, he set it up between Mizpah and a place called Shen, which is a Hebrew word that means a tooth. As far as we know, there's no Hebrew town called Shen. We're not sure where Shen is at. And so since we don't know where Shen is at, we don't know where Ebenezer is exactly at either. But it's between Mizpah and Shen. Maybe there was a jut of rock sticking out of a hill that looked somewhat like an incisor or something. And they called it the tooth. But that being said, we know where Israel was mustering the troops, here at Mizpah in 1 Samuel 4. Or close to Mizpah. No, I'm sorry. They're at Ebenezer in 1 Samuel 4. Again, Ebenezer, not sure where it's at. The Philistines are gathering here in a town called Aphek. Now, there were several Aphek's in the Old Testament, so don't let that confuse you either. There's one on the other side of the Jordan River, and there's one farther up north, because Aphek is a Hebrew word that means the fortress. It would have been a Philistine stronghold at the time, and kind of the word fort. Now, we got lots of forts around the country. Fort Pitt. Got one. We've got, what else is there over that direction? Yeah, there's a lot over that way. But Aphek is a word for fort. And so this would be the place where all the people of Philistia would gather to muster the army before they'd go out to battle. They're preparing an invasion force. And so they gather all of their people at Aphek. Interestingly enough, here's a little tidbit for all of you nerds out there that like linguistic studies. And I know that's all of you, right? We'll just pretend that's everybody, so act interested. The Philistine, when you're looking at Hebrew words, Hebrew, ancient Hebrew doesn't have vowels. You have all consonants, all right? And so, depending on how you vocalize those consonants, you can get slightly different sounds. But in the early 1900s, when Britain had conquered the Middle East and was dividing things up, they wanted to set up a state for Israel and some of the other people that were living there, and they didn't quite know what to call it, so they went to a biblical word, Palestine. Why is it called Palestine? Because Palestine is simply a different vocalization of the Hebrew word Philistine. If you take out the vowels, all the consonants are the same, Philistine. Okay, so you can get Philistine or you can get Palestine, depending on how you vocalize that P. And again, in ancient Hebrew, there's a little dot that signifies whether it should be a P or a F sound. But it's the same Hebrew letter for P or for F. And the ancient manuscripts, the really old ones, didn't use the vowel points. That's not until you get to some of the later ones that we have the vowel points. So you can vocalize those things different ways. But Palestine is the new way to say Philistine. And so when they talk about the Palestinians over there, we are, in a sense, talking about the descendants of the Philistines. Okay? They've changed religion a little bit, but the descent is still there. So, why is the two-state solution not going to work in Israel? Never has, never will. Yeah? You won't be able to ensure peace in the Middle East through a two-state solution. Anyway, that's my political commentary for the evening. For the national security person listening in on this. All right. So the Philistines are camping here at Aphek. This is where they're mustering their armies. They're getting ready to invade. The Israelites are somewhere between Mizpah and an unknown spot. We could probably place them, who knows, right around in here up in the hill country, but we're not entirely sure. But it's kind of a detail that doesn't change the narrative all that much. But the Philistines drew up in line against Israel. That's a way of saying they got ready for battle. We do battle quite a bit differently these days. We don't have nearly as many troops in a battle line as we used to, and we tend to spread them out because if you have artillery and grenades and bombs going off, you don't want them taking out your entire group of men with one shot. So we spread out. Well, that wasn't the way they did it back then. Maybe if you've seen movies of the Revolutionary War or even the Civil War, the kind of the craziness of it. Everybody just lined up in a couple of rows, and you'd get the guys in front and get down on their knees and aim their rifles, and you'd have both armies standing in two rows opposite each other, just shooting at non-moving targets. It's one of the reasons we won the Revolutionary Wars, because we decided to get away from that method of warfare. Well, the British didn't like it. They thought we weren't playing by the rules, and they called us terrorists because we would scatter our guys and hide behind trees and hills and fences and anything that would stop a bullet from hitting our troops. And the British would just stand there in nice, neat formation, looking very, very regal as they got slaughtered. But this is how they would do warfare. The two sides would line up, they'd shout at each other, they'd try and raise their adrenaline levels and get ready for the fight, and then they'd all charge in, and the swords would start swinging, and the spears would be flying, and the arrows would be zinging through the air, and it was a messy, messy affair. Warfare in the ancient world was, warfare in any time is a horrible thing, but it was bloody, and many, many people died. We look at today's casualty reports from some of our battles like D-Day, say in one day, 6,000 men on just that first day of invasion. So that's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. But again, in ancient battles, hate to say it this way, but it was nothing to lose 50, 60,000 people in a day because of the way they fought, and because it was so personal, and because it was hand-to-hand combat. So they line up. They drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. Now, it says Israel was defeated, but we know that this wasn't a complete rout, because in the next few verses, we find the troops of Israel come back to the camp. There in verse 3, and when the troops came to the camp, so they went to the battle, they got defeated, but they came back to camp. So they weren't completely destroyed, they weren't completely routed, and there was no retreat or all-out rout going on at this point. But they did lose that day. They lost 4,000 people. We're not told how many were in the Israeli army at the time, but it was a significant enough number that they were willing to come back to camp at Ebenezer and realize that they had been defeated. Which brings us to... there we go. Oh, you know what? Because now I've got to switch back to that mode. Try this. Nope, that's not going to do it either, huh? Well then. We'll just go from right there. Okay. All right, so they have this surprise defeat, and the fact that they are surprised that they were defeated comes out in verse 3. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? They don't understand why they lost. In modern warfare, because we are a very, and I use the term philosophically, modern, we're a very modern people. We tend to look at things from a very naturalistic standpoint. So if we lose a battle, it's because we used the wrong tactics, or we didn't have the right weaponry, or we were outmanned or outgunned. But the ancient peoples really didn't think about things that way. Even the nations that were not Israelite, were not genuine believers, they had this conception that the outcomes of battles were the direct results of the doings of the gods. And Israel has got this concept of as well, because she understands that Jehovah is in control of these events. She at least understands this about her God. And as we go further on, we're going to see she's got a lot of misconceptions about Jehovah, and that's part of the failure that is going to come about. But they ask this question, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? They can't understand it. I mean, after all, we're God's chosen people, aren't we? God gave us this land to inherit it, didn't He? He promised us we would kick all these nations out before Him, before us. So why did we lose? Maybe they should have gone back to the lessons of failure in the past. Can you think of another major battle where Israel lost? Eldon? Ai, exactly. And what was the reason they lost? Sin. There was sin in the camp. You would hope that would be the lesson that Israel would take from this failure as well, but they don't. They don't pick up on this. They don't have any concept of self-searching or self-examination to say, why did God allow us to be defeated before our enemies? Well, if we go back to the law, in what God actually said to the people of Israel, you find out that God promised, if you obey me, nobody will be able to stand before you. But if you disobey me and you create other idols, and you worship other gods, and you don't honor my Sabbath day, and you steal, and you kill, and you commit adultery, and you covet, and you dishonor your parents, if you break my covenant, I will make you flee before your enemies. He promised that very, very clearly. So if Israel at this point had been a nation that understood God's covenant and understood what her God was like, she would have taken this lesson, or this failure, as a lesson to say, we must have violated the covenant. There must be something between us and God that's keeping Him from pouring out His blessing upon us the way He promised. But they can't do that. Probably because her leadership is corrupt. Who would they look to teach them those things? Well, who's been judging Israel for the last 40 years? It's been Eli. And we know what sort of a character he is, though I think he's got some levels of faithfulness in him, some deep trust in Jehovah. Yet, on the other hand, he's got some real failings as a leader because he can't even get his own sons to worship Jehovah properly. And they have been leading Israel down a path of unrighteousness and blasphemy for many, many years, and he's been impotent to be able to stop those things. And so this defeat comes as a surprise to Israel, which is a real shame. As we get on to the next section, we're going to see that they have also a misplaced faith. And when the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Here's our solution." Where it should have been, "Let's repent. Let's do some searching. Let's ask God why we were defeated." That's what Joshua did. Even though he didn't know specifically what sin had been committed under his command, when he searched for it, God showed it to him. And he dealt with it. And Israel was able to move on, and they conquered the entire land of Canaan. But the people of Israel at this point don't do that. Here's our solution, "Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh so that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." Here's their misplaced faith. Because what are they trusting to save them? The Ark. Instead of the God who sits enthroned on it. Now you might say that's a subtle distinction. And yes, it is a subtle distinction, but it is a distinction. When you let the symbol become more meaningful to you than the thing it represents. Do we have symbols in the church today? Yes, we do. What's the biggest symbol in the church today? The most recognizable one, the cross. Yeah, you find it on jewelry, you find it on tattoos, you find it on clothing. You find it all over the place. We hang it as hangings on our walls. We put that cross everywhere. Why? Why do we do that? Because it's supposed to remind us of what started the church. The one who hanged on that cross. Is it hanged or hung? Hanged. It's supposed to remind us of the one who hanged on that cross. The cross itself is meaningless. The cross itself is just an object. And yet how often do people think, "Oh, I'm going to wear this cross on my necklace, and that's going to be..." If I wear that cross, if I put a really big Bible on my living room table, then my house will never burn down, my finances will be good. And how often do we do that? And we treat God's symbols, right symbols, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with symbolism because we use them and they're needful, but how often do we treat the symbol as an idol? We just read about it in our family devotions. One of the kings had to destroy the bronze serpent that Moses created in the wilderness. When the poisonous snakes were coming into the camp and biting everybody, and God told him to erect that bronze serpent. Incidentally, the source of the medical symbol that we use today. Well, he had to destroy it because the people were worshiping it as a god. And there is the propensity of the human heart to corrupt everything that God gives us. We turn everything that God gives us and we try to turn it into an idol. And we stop focusing on the God that gave it and we start focusing on the thing. And Israel had done this. They had, in the ancient world, things called talismans. Lucky charms, rabbit's feet, horseshoes. Why do you hang a horseshoe over your barn door? It's supposed to be good luck, right? Why do you carry a rabbit's foot with you? It's supposed to be good luck. What happens if a black cat runs in front of your path? Well, that's bad luck. What happens if you break a mirror? Well, that's really bad luck. 7 years bad luck, right? Well, Luck is an expression of one of the Norse gods. It has its base in paganism. We still talk about those things somewhat. We think of them as superstitious, but they were really based in pagan religion. Omens. And the ancient peoples believed strongly in omens. In fact, one of the things they used to do was they would cut open sheep and they would examine the innards. And depending on how the innards had grown in that sheep, they would determine what their gods wanted them to do. Aren't you glad we don't have to do that today? Call me up, say, Pastor Brian, I'd like to know what God would want me to do about this situation, what job I should take. And I'd say, very good, why don't you bring your sheep over? And we open it up and we start looking at its liver. And they had encyclopedias full of information about how to interpret the size and shape of animals' guts. But they had a misplaced faith because Israel was no longer basing its concept of God on how God had revealed himself to them in his covenant. They were basing their concept of God, of Jehovah, on what the nations around Israel thought. The Philistines believed in omens, they believed in talismans, they believed in idols and the power of objects to bring about the will of their gods. And Israel had adopted those concepts and brought them into her own relationship with Jehovah, which was destructive. And they lost the battle, and they don't understand why. So they say, hey, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh so that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. They have a misplaced faith. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. Now understand, that's a commentary that the writer of Samuel put into it. That's not what they're thinking. They don't have any concept that we're going to bring in the Ark because God is there. What they're saying is, let's bring the Ark. This thing's powerful. Instead of thinking that it's the God who sits on the cherubim that is powerful. He's the one that will save us. Because again, if they were looking to him, they would have repented. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. Now again, if these people had any concept of being in a right relationship with God, according to the covenant that God had given them, they would never have brought Phinehas and Hophni with the Ark. Because everybody knew what Phinehas and Hophni were like. They were not men after God's own heart. They were not fulfilling all of the requirements of the priesthood. They were not ideal Levitical priests. And it's not that they're looking for perfection, but you say these guys are as far off from perfection as you can get. They should have been deposed, and yet the people, when they bring them in, are excited. Look at verse 5. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. They are excited that the Ark has come and that the priests of God are there with them. Because in their minds, this is good. This is good luck. Jehovah has to be with us now because we've brought his Ark. As if God were in a box. If God were bound to that Ark to say, I'd really like to let Israel lose to teach him a lesson, but what can I do? My Ark's there. But that's not the way things are going to go. Because we're going to see the tragic consequences of this failure. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. And here again, you're going to see their concept of the idea of these objects. It's, again, it's magic talismans. It's Lucky Charms, not the cereal. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, "A god has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods?" You see any misunderstanding about Jehovah there? Mighty gods? Apparently Israel had not been enough of an influence on her neighbors that the Philistines don't even know this little bit, that when the people of Israel reference Yahweh Elohim, Elohim is a plural, by the way, they're not talking about many gods, they're talking about one God. "These are the gods," again, this misunderstanding, "who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness." Now, they at least have heard about what God did to the Egyptians, even though it wasn't in the wilderness. He struck the Egyptians in their own country. But even at that, even with the misunderstanding, the fear of Jehovah is somewhat put into the people around Israel because 400 years earlier, they had heard what God had done to the Egyptians and to the Canaanites when Israel entered the land. Take courage. Here's their response. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, yes, you, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. So they by no means have a fatalistic view of this. Not in any way, shape, or form are they thinking, uh-oh, the Ark's here, we're all dead men. They're saying, we'd better try harder. We'd better get those swords in our hands, get out there, and give it our all, because we do not want to become slaves to the Israelites. And so they rally themselves up. They whip themselves into a frenzy. In verse 10, so the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled every man to his home, and there was a very great slaughter. For there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Now, whereas the first day of battle was simply a defeat, 4,000 men died and all Israel went back to the camp to muster themselves and to regroup, this second day of the battle went much worse. Because now, instead of going back to the camp to regroup, where's everybody going? They fled. Home. Go home. Get away from this place. We don't want to get slaughtered. Unfortunately, they did get slaughtered. 30,000 people died. Now, that's a huge number of people in one day. The tragic consequences of failure are this: because Israel wouldn't listen to what God had told them in His covenant with them, they wouldn't be instructed by God about how He had revealed Himself. They wanted to conceive of God the way all the nations around her conceived of God. They lost the battle. And not only did they lose the battle, they were soundly defeated. And this had repercussions for Israel far into the future, because you're not just fighting a battle to say, hey, I win, ha ha. The loser of the battle becomes servants of the winner. And now the nation of Israel, because they have lost, is in a weak position, and they're going to be subjected to taxation. They're going to be subjected to bullying. They're going to be subjected to all sorts of controls by the Philistines. In fact, later on, we're going to find out that when David's going to battle, we find there's no swords in the army of Israel. Why not? Because the Philistines came in because of these events, because Israel was defeated and became servants of the Philistines, and they wouldn't allow the Israelites to make weaponry. Well, if you don't let people have weapons, you can kind of control the population a lot better. Our founding fathers understood the same things, why they gave us the Second Amendment. Because the armies of these people were not drawn from an elite group of trained soldiers. They were, every man was responsible to, every family contributed men to the army. Okay? So you all had to have your weapons. But the tragic consequences of this failure were the defeat of Israel. And not only was Israel defeated and now became a vassal state to Palestine, or to the Philistines, but because of their conception that all the events in the lives of men were outworkings of the relationship between the different gods, who got defeated? In the minds of the Philistines, they're looking at this battle saying, aha, Jehovah is not as strong as our God, Dagon. They're going to credit Dagon with the victory, and they're going to credit Jehovah with a loss. And now that means that not only is the nation of Israel a vassal state, but it also means that the God of Israel, Jehovah, is now a vassal to Dagon, at least in the minds of the Philistines. How important is correcting us, disciplining us to our God when He's willing to undergo those sorts of humiliations in order to teach us a lesson? That's what He's going to do with Israel. There's the tragic consequences of failure. Because they didn't trust God, because they didn't obey His commands, Israel's defeated. The nation loses prestige and honor, and also Jehovah loses His honor and glory in the eyes of the nations around Israel because of their faithlessness. And Hophni and Phinehas die. Well, next we have the heartbreaking report. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day. Now, I tell you, I searched and searched and searched to try and figure out if this was an extremely important fact. I think it is. Because he comes on the same day. Now, Aphek is 22 miles from Shiloh, where the Philistines gathered for battle, 22 miles from where the tabernacle's at. Now, we know that the battle didn't happen there. It happened somewhere between there. We're not entirely sure, but if it's maybe 10, 10 or 15 miles away, here we have this man who runs from the battle, runs maybe 10 miles, and is able to get to Shiloh the same day the battle happened. So what does that tell us? That battle was over quick. And if it happened that quickly, to give this man time enough to run back to Shiloh to give this report, that means the battle was over earlier in the morning. 30,000 men of Israel died, and Israel was defeated that completely in a very short period of time. So the man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn with dirt on his head. And when he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching. Why? For his heart trembled for the ark of God. Here again we see some of Eli's faithfulness, that I think Eli does have a genuine concern for God's honor and glory, even though he wouldn't stand up for it to the face of his sons. Because the ark of God is gone, he's worried about how this battle is going to go. And so the whole time the ark is gone, and it may have been a couple of days by this point, he's sitting and he's waiting. Waiting for news of how the battle is going to go. Waiting for news of what's going to happen. And I think, I'm conjecturing at this point, and I'll admit that, but I think that he's already drawn the conclusion that his sons are dead men. Because of the prophecy that was given to him about them, that Samuel delivered, in one day your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will die. Because of the prophecy that years ago the man of God gave him, said your family line is no longer going to serve as a priest. I think that Eli is fairly certain this is going to be the day it happens. Because what's he concerned for? The ark. Now I might be reading into that a little bit. But we see there that he certainly notes that the one thing Eli is concerned about is the ark of God. Whether or not he expects his sons to come back, I'm not sure. But when he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. So the man comes to the city gates. Obviously, they see it's bad news. He tells a few people, and that just starts spreading like wildfire throughout the city. Israel's been defeated. And again, the implications of that are that Israel is now a vassal state to the Philistines. It's not a good scenario for Israel. And Eli heard the sound of the outcry. He says, "What is this uproar?" Apparently he didn't hear the initial report. Then the man hurried and came and told Eli. He gets first-hand report from this. He's not hearing it from the other people in the city. He's hearing it from the messenger. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am he who has come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." And he said, it's Eli said, "How did it go, my son?" Well, I kind of just told you how it went. I fled from the battle. That's not a good sign. Now, Eli apparently can't see the torn clothes and the dirt on his head, the signs of mourning. So Eli asked him, "How did it go?" And he who brought the news answered and said, "Here's the bad news I'm going to deliver you. Israel has fled before the Philistines." There's bad news number one. We were soundly beaten. We didn't just retreat. It's not a tactical regrouping. This is a whipping. Israel's been beaten. They're all fleeing from before the Philistines. That's bad news. "And there has been a great defeat among the people." Now that's not saying two things, or saying one thing two ways. The first one is, we lost the battle. The second one is, we lost a lot of people. There's been a great defeat. The number of Israelites that fell today is huge. 30,000 men. Not only does that mean 30,000 fewer men to fight in the army, but it also means 30,000 fewer husbands and fathers to till the land, to work in the economy, to bring prosperity, to take care of their families. Now you've got widows and orphans. Okay? This is a huge, huge deal, this number of people being lost. And the number is actually 34,000 between the 2 days of battle. Okay. So this is the heartbreaking report. "We were defeated. A lot of people died. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead." Third piece of bad news. Your sons are both gone. Now again, I think somewhat that Eli was expecting this. Because even back when he was given the news, he accepted it. When Samuel delivered that message, he said, "God is the Lord, let him do as seems fit to him." And he had that simple resignation to what God's plan and purposes for him were in disciplining him. So I think probably he expected this. But here's the fourth piece of bad news. All right? Number one, we've been defeated. Number two, a lot of people have died. Number three, your two sons are dead. Number four, the ark of God has been captured. That symbol that represented the presence of God in Israel. And again, the symbol's not a bad thing. The fact that it's a symbol is not a bad thing, but when you trust in the symbol instead of the God, that's what's bad. And so the fact that this symbol was captured is a huge blow to Israel. And as soon as he mentioned verse 18, now notice what he mentions here that's going to cause this next result. As soon as he mentioned what? The ark. Not the defeat, not the number of people lost, not the two sons dead. As soon as he mentioned the ark being captured, here's what Eli had been worrying about. Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Here's this heartbreaking report that brings these tragic consequences. That what God prophesied to Eli has come to pass. His sons are both dead. Israel's been defeated. Her God, for all visible representations, has been taken into exile into Philistine territory. Now we know God can't be taken captive. We know that God can't be defeated. What he allows for his own purposes and his own glory. But it was a blow to the nation of Israel to have these things happen. So that's the heartbreaking report. The inglorious conclusion in verses 19 to 22. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and was about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, now this would be news that would bring trauma on anybody, but for a poor woman who's very, very pregnant at the time, it was too much. And it induced her into bearing her child. Her pains came upon her. She bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." So they're trying to encourage her and say, "Yeah, we understand you're not going to make it, but don't worry, your son's okay." And all of us that are parents understand that. If we knew that our time was at an end, but that our children were going to be fine, that is a huge amount of comfort. But look at what she does with that news. She almost completely ignores it. She doesn't say a thing about it. Don't be afraid. She did not answer or pay attention, and she named the child Ichabod, which means no glory. No glory. Now we tend to name our children things that sound good. The ancient peoples tended to name their children things that had deep meaning to them. Israel was a prince of God. Jacob meant supplanter. So we have all these names throughout the scriptures that mean something, have deep meaning to them. And here is this poor guy's name. No glory. Not good looking. Inglorious is his name. She named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel." And notice why she says that. It's not because her husband is dead. It's not because her father-in-law is dead. It's because the ark of God had been captured. The reputation in the nations of Israel's God had just been tarnished in a huge way. But this is all just fulfillment of what Hophni and Phinehas and Eli started. These are the tragic consequences of failure. And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." That symbol of God's presence with Israel was gone for a time, representing that God himself had departed from his people and was allowing them to experience these defeats. Now we know that God always allows defeats for a purpose, and those purposes are to teach us lessons. And so the kingly lesson from this chapter is this. How do you do with failures? Failure and its consequences are gracious gifts to teach us obedience. Isn't that a hard thought to get our minds around? Because how many of you like to fail? Go ahead, raise your hand. I enjoy it. I enjoy it when I blow it big time. I just love it. Okay. No, we don't. It's embarrassing. We like to think of ourselves as being better than that. We want to do well. We have a genuine desire to do right. If the Spirit of Christ is within us and we're walking with Him, that desire is there. But when we fail, We understand our own failure, and it is hard to deal with, so we don't enjoy it. And when the consequences of failure come upon us, most of us are not, "Woohoo! Yeah, this is great!" Did you like being spanked as a kid, Eldon? I'm assuming you got a few. I know I did. Okay. Yeah, probably. Yep. But God tells us even in His Word that now no discipline is enjoyable for the present moment. Nobody likes being disciplined. Israel wasn't going to enjoy this time in her life, but there was a good purpose behind it, and it was to bring her back to a right relationship with God, which it's going to do. And Samuel's going to be the leader of that. But in order for Samuel to take the lead of the nation, Eli had to be removed. And again, it's not that Eli lost his salvation, it's not that he was eternally separated from God, but it was the judgment that God levied upon him for his failures, for his sins. But all failure, or I should say the consequences, are gracious gifts to teach us obedience. So the kingly lesson we get from the people of Israel is this: learn from failure and listen to rebuke. Learn from your failures and listen when you're rebuked for them. Any questions or comments? It's a lot of ground we covered, and I realize we're a couple of minutes past. I must have explained it well. That, or you're all just saying, just let us out of here. Right? All right, let's go ahead and pray. Our Father, You treat us as beloved children because You don't allow us to continue on in our sin. You discipline us. You allow us to experience the consequences of our failures so that we can learn what the deadly consequences of sin are. And yet, Lord, Your hand is always with us to protect us from the worst that we could possibly commit as You shield us from that. Lord, You guide us. You protect us from all that we could be as Your Spirit works within us and conforms us to the image of Christ and we grow day by day. And I pray we would be people who learn from our mistakes, who learn from the correction not only of our failures, but also from the failures of people that we read about in Your Word, because You recorded those events so that we could learn from them, not have to repeat the mistakes. And so, Father, help us to go out from here encouraged of Your love for us, encouraged of Your sovereign control over the events of our lives, just as You were in Israel's day, and encouraged that You are going to bring about godliness within us. And we praise You for it in Jesus' name.